All right, Bruce Jenkins joins us from the San Francisco Chronicle. Bruce, good morning, a Sunday morning of baseball.
Absolutely. Marty, how are you?
Oh, very, very well. And this is, you know, it's my favorite day, and I put it out to the audience today. Where are you today, and what are you doing? And, you know, I have this image of what I did. You know, on Sunday morning, you get the paper, which the archaic paper, of course, and sit and hold it.
I have the paper.
Yes, and I still do. Come on, you know. And I'd sit and look at the sports section and, you know, just take a look at the averages for the week. You know, what the hitter, that long list of averages, and see who would be under 200. And that's the way you got your baseball news.
Yeah, I'm still that way. I mean, I've been on the internet probably the last couple hours, you know, reading up on everything I can possibly find from around the country. But the real essence of really any morning for me is a little coffee and the morning papers, the Chronicle, the Mercury. I get USA Today. I can get anything I get my hands on and hold in my hands. That's a good day for me.
Yeah, it's a good part of baseball because it's an everyday story, and every day you get to do that. But I used to like, remember the averages they put, the long list.
Yeah, on Sundays you'd have everybody's average.
And that's the only way you could ever figure out who was hitting what.
Yeah, that's true. I really missed that. I haven't seen that in years.
That was now you don't need it anymore.
Well, that's true, but you can find it. You can always find that.
Right, the Mendoza line. That's where that came around. If you're under 200, you're under the Mendoza line.
Yeah. It's still better than just having it right in front of you as you read the paper, as opposed to having to look it up. You know what I mean? It's just a little bit easier, a little bit cooler.
Well, we had an interesting talk with Alex this morning and last night on YouTube. I got to see the latest rage of mascots or in-game entertainment. I don't know if you've seen it at all. I've heard about it, but the squirrel.
Yeah.
Have you seen this?
Yeah, I saw it. Was watching last night. It was very funny. Yeah, you know, it kind of, because it's San Diego, it reminded me of when they unveiled the San Diego Chicken, still the greatest of all mascots, and something that can go terribly wrong in the wrong hands, which we've seen all over baseball, this preposterous mascots, certainly not all of them, but a lot of them. And this is the same kind of thing that if it were to try to duplicate it somewhere, it could just get really, really old. But for what they've got going there, I think it's got longevity, at least for this season.
Yeah, I mean, it's the expression on the guy's face because he's wearing the squirrel outfit, and he looks like a squirrel.
Yeah, and he's just faster than heck. I mean, he gives the guy like a 30-yard head start and just dusts him.
I love it. It was funny. I get those mascots, and we haven't really talked. The Philly Fanatic has withstood the time test. He's hung in there.
Yeah, any time you get a little wit attached to it, and if the outfit isn't just ridiculous looking in itself, like Mr. Matt or that incredibly hideous thing they have in Colorado, I don't even know what it is. But
I was just going to say both of those.
Yeah. Yeah, those two come quickly to mind. And they always seem to pop up behind home plate in the center field cameras. Like, get out of there, for God's sake.
You can't. I've done a show on this. How this Colorado mascot gets to be distressed. It's like foul shots in basketball. You know, that's what goes on when someone's shooting.
You can't get rid of him. And he's ugly, and he doesn't really do anything. It's this ridiculous face. You know?
The Cincinnati Reds one is also, that's another one.
Oh, God.
Yeah, that's funny. Oh, boy. Hey, we had Steve Travers on today about the book The Poet, about Jim Murray. And I know you've contributed mightily to Steve and the book, and maybe you could give us some perspective on Jim Murray. And I really enjoyed the book. It's a story of the L.A. Times. History in California, of course, Jim Murray, and enough of his columns, really you can feel it. So tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, well, my dad and Jim Murray both moved to the sort of the north end of Malibu, away from even the commotion of regular Malibu, let alone L.A., in the 1950s. Actually, earlier than that, in my dad's case, they got to know each other. My dad was in show business, and Jim obviously was the titan of L.A. sports writing and really the best in the country. And so I wind up going to school with Jim Murray's kids, and one of whom, Tony, was my age. So we were in school together every year from second grade all the way. We wound up going to Cal together. And because of that, I find myself up at the Murray house, not so much to learn anything from Jim or anything like that. I was just hanging out with Tony because we really were best of friends, especially in the junior and high school years. And it sounded like I saw a lot of Jim Murray. He was in that, he had a separate office, sort of away from the commotion of the family, and was always churning out columns, and every year a new plaque would arrive, you know, National Sports Writer of the Year. He had like 10 of them, you know, and every now and then he'd pop out to watch something on TV if it was really big, like Russell and Chamberlain or Unitas and Bart Starr, you know, or Arnie and Jack, you know. That sort of watching sports with Jim Murray at the highest level of, you know, competition was really, really a treat. And I just, you know, he was so busy that it wasn't like he was imparting lessons to me or anything like that. I was just being around that environment. I learned an awful lot about humor and perspective, and so that had a huge effect on me. And I was really quite up close to the family dynamic, which went really horribly sour.
Yeah.
I always viewed it as a case of somebody who put so much time into their work, and really all of our dads, so many dads were like that back then. You know, my dad had a separate office. You couldn't go in there unless the main house was on fire, you know.
About Gordon Jenkins, and you wrote a beautiful book about your dad and a great career that he had in the show business.
Yeah, and it's all the dads I knew were sort of like that. They were all about work, and the mom sort of took care of everything. But the kids in the Murray family went really badly astray, like tragically, you know, horribly so. I mean, you know, Tony and Rick are both dead, and it just goes on and on. And I try to impart to Steve what I recall about that era, which is quite a bit.
Well, you've seen the book, I know, the poet.
Yeah.
Yeah, he did a nice job with it.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Steve's very good, very prolific, and a lot of passion.
Yeah, very good with it. And just to talk a little bit more about Jim Murray, his sense of humor it wasn't necessarily a nasty sense of humor. It was just pointing out things about the event.
And it was, yeah.
No one ever was like Jim Murray.
No, it was very biting, though. I mean, he went to Indianapolis and was just marveling at the Indy 500, you know, at the spectacle of people perhaps, you know, losing their lives. And he opened his column with, "Gentlemen, start your coffins."
Okay. Yeah, I remember that.
And he took on cities. He'd take on Cincinnati or Kansas City as a, you know, sort of a low rent town, and he caused tremendous, you know, amounts of outrage in all these places. But basically, his sense of humor was very biting and very sarcastic, but always right on the money.
Yeah.
And it really shaped the way that I sort of look at things. I mean, all the Murrays were that funny. Every single person in the family, the three kids and the daughter and the mom.
Yeah.
And sitting around the dinner table with them, I swear I could barely eat sometimes. I was laughing so hard.
Very good. Boy, very good. I'm glad that you could be on this morning to talk about that. Well, the ball club has lost four in a row. It is April. They're still 13-11. Colorado chugs along. Arizona had a nice win last night. Dodgers got beat, another injury in their pitching staff. And here we are in the National League West. It's shaping up to be, you know, this is going to be a race.
Yeah, it's just so interesting how many new faces keep popping in. Who was the guy, McGill for the Dodgers?
Yeah, and he was like a low pick. I mean, not, you know, it was not very well considered, and he was in Albuquerque, and next thing you knew, Billingsley's hurt, Fife is hurt, and now it's Matt McGill.
I was just getting used to Fife. You know, now it's McGill, and Arizona with this kid Gregorius at shortstop is a real interesting dynamic added to that team. He got popped in the head, which is very unfortunate, and let's hope he comes out of that. But he had a huge impact on the Giants series. Now they're going to go back and try to keep him a little bit more in check. But, you know, aside from the Kemps and the Tula Whiskeys, you know, you have really interesting new faces on some of the, on all of the teams, really. And that keeps it fresh. It's going to be, it could be a much more complicated race than we thought at the start.
Yeah, I think so. I'm starting to see that. You know, and part of it is pitching. And the Giants generally have the solid pitching. But as I said, the one stat in 24 games to have, I think I said, 9 multiple run innings of 3 runs or more, that's a lot in a pitching staff. You know, you think you could shut it down at some point, but I watched the games, and you do too. Just watch where the pitches are located. And these guys with the bats, they have such bat speed, they don't miss them.
Oh, jeez. Yeah, I know. It's a brutal thing, and trying to pitch in the big leagues when you're not completely sharp, because, like you say, they just don't miss. I mean, even if you're throwing 98, if you put it right down the pipe, that thing's jacked out of here, you know, dead pull by somebody. So, and I did hear a little bit of what Alex was saying, and it, you know, it's not like the Giants, you know, their arms are falling off or anything like that. He can see the bite on their breaking pitches and the off-speed pitches, and the velocity is decent. It's just maybe a little bit of loss of focus, you know, after the incredible highs they went through in the World Series. And I don't think anything really to be alarmed at. It just, you know, you can't blow a 5-0 lead in San Diego. But, you know, it happens, and then you move on.
Yeah, and Barry Zito, I think, is 127-2 when you give him four runs or more. And, you know, generally you can shut it down. In fact, he had one moment last night. I kind of liked it. It was a tough at bat. It was the inning before. And Posey put down like 17 signs. And Zito didn't want any of them.
Yeah, right.
And Posey finally said, all right, let me go out there and ask. And Zito did all the talking and came back with a curveball and struck him out in a big moment. And I said, boy, he calls his own game.
Until it went sour, Zito was pitching exactly the kind of game that we've been raving about, you know, for several months dating back to last year. And I was, you know, following the tweets from the guys there. They were raving about this and that, and it was, you know, absolutely right. And then all of a sudden, his ball got a little bit too much of the plate. And, you know, for him, that's deadly, especially with the fastball. But any pitcher hangs anything, you're going to pay the price.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, the Twitter world is pretty funny during the game, and with all the, you know, Andy and Alex and people like that, John Shea tweeting. So, of course, I tweet during the game. I said, well, Zito's calling his own game. Nice job and all that. And Vince Catronio, right? The A's broadcaster. Next tweet, after Zito gives up six runs, is he still calling his own game? Right?
There you go.
And
yeah.
I sent back to him, he was distracted by the squirrel. You know, that's what it's turned into.
Yeah, the squirrel, he got Torres, he got Zito. I think Scudero was still a little bothered by it all the way back in
really?
12th. You know?
Boy, it's nice to be early in the season, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, you find out who you are. You know, I think this sort of stretch the Giants are having is going to help them in the long run, because I think fundamentally there's not a whole lot to worry about. But you can't just come back off of a World Championship season, make every play, make every pitch. You know, you got to work hard for it. It's a new season. The other teams are hungry. Maybe a little hungrier. Who knows right now?
Yeah. And look, I always say teams don't realize how bad they are in April.
Yeah.
In August, they'll know how bad they are. And
it'll
look different. There's always danger in playing teams in April, because they're still somewhat fresh out of spring training. So I always remember that. Today, you've got a basketball game. Very exciting for you today.
Yeah, I'm probably going to jump on BART over there today, because the A's game will be letting out and the Warriors fans will be streaming in, and you don't know quite when that's going to happen, so I think that's probably a good call. But yeah, back into the mayhem of Oracle Arena and playoff basketball. It's really, really, really fun, and it's just great that the fans of that team can really settle into this best-of-seven series. You know, it's so different from the regular season, and you know the Warriors could win the series. I mean, they're playing great, and it's just an awful lot of fun.
Yeah, it is good for the Bay Area. Hey, I had Don Baylor on this morning, and you know, Chu of Cincinnati's been hit like 10 times in the first.
Man, what's going on there?
He set some sort of record. So I said Don Baylor was in town. I said I want to talk to him, and he said something interesting. He said, "Look, if the count was 0-2, I wanted to get hit." Because I was 2/3 of a way to a strikeout.
Yeah.
And he says he never wore a pad. Ron Hunt, remember the old Giant, wore the rubber suit underneath. And he has, everyone's wearing pads. And he says, I never wore anything because it hurt my swing. He was a ball player.
Yeah. That was the one thing the only thing that ever bothered me about Barry Bonds at the plate was the fact that he had that armor on there and could take just a howling fastball there and not even really feel it.
Yeah.
It's almost like cheating. I mean, you've got to be able to have a little bit of fear of reprisal or getting hit. And, you know, Baylor, Frank Robinson, all those guys from the past, you know, hung in there and got hit, took their base, and maybe if they're a little upset, maybe they try to take the second baseman out.
That's what he said. That's exactly what he said. That's the only way we could, because, you know, that's the way the game was played. I think Biggio broke his record, didn't he? Doesn't Biggio have the record?
Yeah, I think he did. Yeah, there's another guy, another old school kind of.
Yeah. Oh, nice to talk to you.
Sure, Marty, always.
Yeah, so we got the Dodgers next week, and I hope you'll be out at the park, and we'll see you at the Public House.
You got it.
All right, have a good afternoon,
okay.
Bruce. All right,
soon.
That is Bruce Jenkins. Always a pleasure to have him on as we do our segment, Looking Through the Window of Baseball with Bruce Jenkins, and that's brought to you by Marvin Windows and Doors and Truitt and White, the professional builder's choice. Boy, do I look forward to that every Saturday and Sunday with Bruce.